The Guardian.
I was waiting, knowing that there would be change, that it would not always be like this. I was aware how easy it would be once I was in those corridors again, for one of the guards to notice me if I made a sound or if I moved quickly, so that there would be some disturbance in the air. And then slowly, I began to understand why I was here and who I was looking for. His name did not come to me, and I was not able to picture his face, but I felt that he was close. I could imagine the guard who had seen me or who had noticed my presence consulting one of the other guards, and then both of them approaching him, the one I am searching for, or his friend who looks after him. My husband is dead and my daughter, they have become pure shade. My other daughter is here, but the one I am searching for is my son. I am awake. The words I knew are sleeping. Sometimes they turn in the night or make some sound in their vast dreaming, and then they wake too. Often, if only for a second, they open their eyes and watch me. I hold their gaze so that they might remember me as they fall back into sleep. I study them in their inert state. I'm alert to any movement they make. I can hear their dark groanings in the night, intermittent against their breathing. I can see them reach their arms towards me to be lifted. I can tell the difference between night and day now. I know the silence that descends on the gardens and corridors at night, a silence broken only by the soft movements of the guards or of cats. This is my realm where I'm free to wander. As I come from the garden, I'm aware the guards can feel a movement in the air. It would just take it one more thing to let them know that I'm with them, a sound, a darting gesture. When the time came, I knew that I would hear his name, my son's name, enough to whisper it like someone imploring. It would come to me when I needed it. Orestes. I whispered on one of those nights, and then I withdrew into the shadows. Orestes. I repeated, letting my voice echo down the corridor. I saw two of the guards running back and forth and then summoning the other one, my son's friend, who strutted up and down, checking doorways and corners. I waited until he had gone, and then I whispered to one of the guards, "Tell Orestes that I'm his mother. He must come alone into the corridor. He must be alone." The guard made as though to run, but then stopped himself. "Speak again," he said quietly, his head bowed. "Tell Orestes. Come along," I said. "Now?" "Yeah, soon. Orestes must come soon." "Do you mean to cause him harm?" he asked. "No, I do not mean to cause him harm."
Hello, I'm Claire Armistead, and this is the Guardian Books Podcast. Colm Toybean is the author of 9 novels, including Brooklyn and Nora Webster, and has 3 times been shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. Among the inner lives he has reimagined are those of Henry James in The Master and the mother of Jesus in The Testament of Mary. In his latest novel, House of Names, he reconstructs the tragedy of Clytemnestra and Agamemnon. In this brutal story of a family at war, Clytemnestra waits for her husband to return victorious from battle. But before he left 9 years earlier, he'd sacrificed their beautiful young daughter to the gods, and now she's plotting her revenge and his death. Their 2 surviving children, Orestes and Electra, cannot escape the bloody violence that swirls around the court, and no one is safe. Charlotte Higgins, The Guardian's chief culture writer, met Colm at a Guardian Live event at the Islington Assembly Hall in London. She began by asking whether the irrational cycles of violence of the Troubles informed how he brought these old stories to life.
The first book I wrote was a book called Bad Blood, Walking Along the Irish Border. I walked west-east, so when I came over, this is 1986, so I come to the town of Bessbrook, which is in Armagh, and I really don't want to do what I have to do now, which is knock on 2 doors. And the 2 doors are the 2 survivors of the Kingsmill Massacre. In his Nobel speech, Seamus Heaney said, "This was the most harrowing event in the harrowing of the heart in Northern Ireland, when there were 12 men, January 1976, coming back in the evening from work in a minibus, And they were stopped, they thought, by the British Army, but it wasn't the British Army, and they didn't know who it was. And the men said, I mean, the people at guns said, there's one of among you who's a Catholic, and he must stand out. In Heaney's version of the story, the Protestant man beside the Catholic just holds his hand, saying, we're with you, don't stand out. But the man eventually stands out, and they just say, you run, run. And they shoot the 11 Protestants, 10 of whom are killed immediately, one of whom survives. So Alan Black was the man who survived, and the other man then was still living also. Both of them were living in this small village. When I went to the house of the Catholic who'd been told to run, it was a ghost came to the door. I mean, I'll never forget him. And when I told him, I said, oh no, listen, I've never talked about this. And he wanted me to go really badly. And then he wanted to say one thing to me. He wanted me to know one thing. Those men were my friends. And then I got one question in to say, did you think they were going to kill you? And then he said, what would you have thought? And then he closed the door. And then I walked back across the village to Alan Black's house. And even though I was a Catholic from the South, Alan Black brought me in and said, look, I don't want to talk about it, but there's a TV documentary made about it for the 10th anniversary. You sit and watch it. It's on a video. And then he put the video. And then he was, would the video work? And he ended up watching it with me. And the two of us sat there watching it. And he hadn't seen it before. And of course, it all came back to him. And I could feel that in the room, the tension and the sorrow, describing, you know, watching the children of these friends who were killed going to school every day without their, you know, not having any father. And also the fact that he knew immediately they were all dead. And he was buried in this mound of bodies, the only one who survived. But when I went and did work on it later, I discovered, of course, that this was done in retaliation. In other words, there wasn't a single incident that occurred out of the blue in the middle of nothing. It was in the middle of a time when there were many such killings in Northern Ireland. This was merely one of the most atrocious. In response to Kingsmill, there were other killings which took place. And in fact, Alan Black ended up sharing a hospital room with survivors of a killing of Catholics done in retaliation for him. And he told me about that, and he became friends with them. And, you know, in other words, that this was a spiral of killings, which reminded me very much of what happens in any civil war, indeed what had happened in the civil war in the South in the early 1920s, of that whole idea of a war going on within a community in which intimate killing will be followed by intimate killing, will be followed by an atrocity to wake everybody up, will be followed by silence, will be followed by one more thing even worse. And so that was always on my mind as something, you know, when I was writing especially those sort of melancholy Irish novels about people living at peace in this Republic of Ireland, realizing that Ireland was sort of built on this in a sense that this was in the background always. My uncle fought in that civil war and was interned during that civil war and was on a hunger strike in that civil war. And my uncle lived until 1995. I mean, he died in his 90s, and I was very close to him. So that it wasn't far away from me, this. And it wasn't as though this was history. It wasn't history. This was family. My uncle, he didn't like cabbage. I think he used the excuse, my aunt used to always say, oh, it was the hunger strike that made him put him off cabbage, as though somehow or other, you know, he was using that as a way of never being, and we all hated cabbage, you know, but he was always the one who was allowed not eat it. And they'd always say, it was the hunger strike, you know. And it would be said in that sort of way, sad, it's sad that he can't eat cabbage as a result of whatever damage was done to his stomach during the hunger strike, you know. And you'd be five or six sort of watching hunger strike, you know. But even the fact that, you know, that I lived in Spain and I have written about the Spanish Civil War and that whole idea of what happened, even in Catalonia, even within families and of individual killings followed by, you know, the all of that idea of civil war was on my mind, that once the genie is out of the bottle or once the spiral of killings begins, it's very, very difficult to stop it. That people feel that, you know, that somehow or other an energy has been released. And it's very difficult to kill that energy, which is really what happens in the book. That really the book opens with Clytemnestra as being a woman who goes with her daughter and her young son to a wedding with all the clothes and all the hope, and she's ready for everything. You know, every happiness that will come her way, even though she knows about this curse or this ancient dark business of this family. But that it will end with her ordering the most atrocious killings.
The Oresteia, by contrast, ends with a judicial process which tamps down the violence, resolves it, and acts as a kind of foundation myth for Athenian democracy. The Furies become kindly ones, and they are set to live, as it were, in the great hill, the Areopagus. They're sort of sent to live underneath this hill as if they're a kind of, they're kindly, they still have this terrifying aspect, perhaps lurking, but they are safely contained within the kind of very soil of Athens. There is no such resolution in the House of Names. Or there's a kind of resolution, but it's shaky.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to bring it as far as I could, where, you know, there's a baby going to be born. Leander is determined, who's sort of running things, there'll be no more killings. Electra is involved with trying to manage other things. But poor Orestes is still really sad and desperate. He doesn't know who he is. And there's a sense also that he's going to go on killing. He really has it in for Aegisthus, who's still alive. He thinks he might kill him soon. And there's a guard he'd like to kill as well. So you feel afterwards it's going to be this trickle of killings. But the elders who are there as the sort of jury, as the sort of deciders, really have taken a sort of power. So there is that sense of civil power emerging in this world, which where the heroic power or the military leaders have been weakened, and now there are these very sensible figures meeting in unison. And so there is an element, I push it as far as I can credibly go, and then leave it open to the reader to realize that nothing is ever as simple as this. It's not as though we're going to build a city on a hill now. That actually, there's going to be, you know, it's going to be uncertain, as it were.
Yeah. The other big resonance, and you talked about this before when you were talking about Syria, and again, this is something Colin wrote about really beautifully in his article for the Guardian Review, was reading this, and it's an article I read too at the time. This absolutely hallucinogenically peculiar article in American Vogue with the al-Assad family of Syria, which somehow this also found, I suppose, the bathos between the kind of highly polished domestic life of that family and the violence that is only really over there.
I mean, I think if you want to know what's going on in the Middle East or how things will plan out, ask Anna Wintour, you know, because she knows. So she knew. I mean, before all this Arab Spring, she said, I know how it's going to be, that this wonderful family have come back from London, they're totally civilized, and they're going to change Syria. And when Syria changes, then Jordan will change, and then it will be all peace, harmony, and democracy in the Middle East. And one woman we're going to feature, I can see the spread already, we're going to call it A Rose in the Desert. And it's going to be a wonderful photograph of Mrs. Al-Assad, dressed very beautifully. And we're going to send our star journalist over to interview her. And the star journalist can really write. So that this piece, it comes online and then they scrub it and then you can find it again. Because Vogue are so ashamed of this article because she went there. And among the things she said about Mrs. Assad was that she had a killer IQ. And you just think, what an oh dear. You know, oh dear. But then Assad, he's a nice guy, comes in his jeans, he has the kids, he pats everyone on the head and starts to talk about himself. He's a sort of TV dad, he likes, the kids decide, a few evenings a week, the kids decide what they're going to eat. And he says, oh, you know, I became an ophthalmologist. Oh, really, because I don't like emergencies and I don't like the sight of blood. Oh, right. You know, you think, and this, you see, this isn't just a pack of lies. This is how these people thought about themselves in reality at certain times of the day. This is how they continued to be. I mean, they're bringing up their children as we speak. They're actually eating together. You know, and he just every so often goes outside the room and just signs something or just nods to somebody. And that's all he needs to, and comes back in and they're watching The Simpsons. You know, and so I was very interested in that idea of a space looked after by Clytemnestra, you know, where the food, the servants, are you too warm? You know, when Orestes comes home, effectively to murder her, she wonders about his bedroom, as your mother always does, you know, is it too warm? Are your blankets okay? And, you know, and she loves him. And they're eating together, Aegisthus, you know, her, Electra, who loathes every one of them. and they're all being served food, and you know, they're trying to pretend they're a normal family at a normal meal. And I was fascinated. I mean, I was fascinated by this article, the whole sense of the home life of the Assads. And I sort of used that idea of not just people telling lies to a journalist, but people actually inventing fictions about themselves for themselves in order to get through the day. The night is a different matter.
The action is very domestic in parts of the book, unlike the Greek theatre, where the action takes place, generally speaking, outside the palace. You know, the palace is behind us, and we are standing outside it, being royal people addressing the people. House of Names is a very it's interior in terms of the fact that it's about interiority, it's about people's thoughts, but it's interior in terms of the fact that it's set inside. And not only do you have this kind of domestic care about where Orestes might be sleeping and is he okay, but also at night, this really kind of terrifying place that's full of secret corridors, people listening in, a kind of Hamlet-like sense of everybody's listening to everybody else. And of course, Orestes is kind of faintly Hamlet-like, although not as smart. How did you think about that sort of geography of that sort of claustrophobic space?
Yes, it's in that space that Orestes can do everything he wants in his own room, but once he goes outside, he can never understand the whispering. He misses the point of almost everything, where Aegisthus is wandering, his sister, everyone is wandering to someone else's room. It is, as you say, like Elsinore. But he's not Hamlet, because he hasn't got the intelligence or the strategy or the wit. But the problem then is within this world, I mean, the Greeks had all the luck, because if you want to murder somebody on the stage, you can just have them walk off stage, the person is to be murdered, have someone follow them with a knife, have the sound of screaming and squealing and yelping and stuff, and then the person coming on with the bloody knife, and you say, oh, but if you're writing a novel...
The messenger speech kicks in.
If you're writing a novel, you really have to build up, and what's he doing the day before? Where is she? Are they having lunch together? Yes. Oh, where's the implement she's going to use? What's his sister saying? Where is she? What's he going to do? Is he going to succeed? Is it going to work? Does his mother suspect for a second? Where are her guards? Will the sign be given at exactly the right moment? And I'm writing this in a small house in East Los Angeles, in the back garden. And my boyfriend says that I came in at one point and looked at him and said, I've just killed Clytemnestra. Can you make me tea? And he said, what have you just done? I said, I couldn't, and it took ages to calm me down, because you cannot write this without feeling it. It's not a technical exercise. You have to get the full emotion, every second, how he's feeling, how it'll go. You have to get right into his mind. And if you don't do that, you lose it. But in order to do that, I mean, it's not natural. I mean, you know, I wish I'd become an ophthalmologist like Bashir al-Assad, where, you know, I wouldn't have to do these things. But, it was where if you're writing a novel, you do have to take the reader through the experience. And in order to do that, you have to go through it yourself. And, there's no point in feeling pity for yourself about it, but it is something that the Greek players didn't have to do with the same extent, I think.
They could outsource that to the actors.
Yeah, they could outsource that. Yeah.
And talking of the setting, if there's a kind of continuum between how granularly evoked settings are in novels, maybe at one extreme there's Muriel Spark, where there's nothing, setting is purely to be imagined by... You know, we don't hear anything about the sofas or the carpets or curtains in Muriel Spark novels. Maybe right through to Hilary Mantel, where we know exactly where the oak chest is placed in relation to the lattice window and what the view out of the window into the Knot Garden looks like, and so forth. You are rather more to the Spark end. Everything is very sparely described. Why? Why not sort of, there's not very much Greek tourist board sort of kind of,
no,
the rustling of the wind in the olives.
Feta cheese. I felt that you could lose the book if you tried the sort of Victorian Albert approach, you know, to put in what fabric was there, what exactly they were eating, and that you just need to know they were eating, but not that as much as what's someone thinking, what's someone saying that's the opposite of what they're thinking, what silence has now developed here? And that I found the same thing when I was writing the Henry James novel. I mean, while I didn't have him calling taxis or using Uber, you know, I didn't describe the inside. I didn't describe, you know, the sound the horses made on the cobbles as they took him to some fancy club. I just had what was going on in his mind. And so the psychology, the drama within the self is what interests me. The historical background, I just want to make sure it's reasonably flat. It's hinterland, but it's not fully colored. I mean, the nearest thing I can think of is to, you know, those Francis Bacon paintings? I read an interview with him where Bacon talked about just the color that's around the figure is often one color, often bright, that he just did it quickly. He just found some color, did it. That's my hinterland. I'm really interested in the whole gnarled business of the self and working with what happens to that in a time of conflict. I mean, Hilary Mantel is extraordinary because she loves having the architecture, the map of how the house was configured to see where the furniture was. And so she thinks in an entirely different way. But I'm much more interested in the stark business of the self or the character or the protagonist.
You're listening to the Guardian Books Podcast. Coming up, Colin will be taking some questions from the audience. But first, a word from our sponsor. You're listening to Colm Toybean being interviewed by Charlotte Higgins at a Guardian Live event. We catch up with the proceedings as Charlotte throws the floor open to the audience.
Why do you think you often take the woman's voice in stories?
Why do I often take the woman's voice in the stories? Because in those plays, Medea, Electra, and Antigone, which are so powerful and speak to us still, it doesn't matter whether they're relevant to our contemporary concerns, but dramatically speak to us. The idea of powerlessness comes across as power once there's voice. That in Antigone, when Creon, the king, speaks, it's like legislation, it's dry, it has no texture. But once Antigone comes on the stage, you cannot take your eyes off her, and you listen to every word she says because out of the fact that she is ready to be crushed comes voice. And that voice has an extraordinary sort of power. And the same thing happens in Medea and in Electra. So that I felt I could still work with that voice. I came across the concept, I mean, I used it first with Mary, the mother of Jesus, where, you know, Jesus in the New Testament, I mean, he really does talk a lot. He's always preaching, and he's got parables, the Sermon on the Mount, and there's no end to the things he has to say. And St. Paul is always writing to the Ephesians. And then the other men, some of them get to write gospels and things, and Mary barely gets to speak. So once the idea would come that if she did speak, and if she was, say, old, after all that had happened, what would this traumatized voice of hers sound like? Perhaps that she could only speak once. And it's that illusion you're creating with these particular speeches, that this is someone speaking once who has been silenced and will be silenced and has this opportunity in time to say once what occurred. And so you can get a texture from that, that actually with those heroines, that comes to us from those heroines and has been used in fascinating ways in recent years by figures like Sylvia Plath in her poems, by the American poet Louise Glück in her poems, that idea of a woman speaking who will be silenced or has been silenced can have a certain sort of special power and tone.
Does that go for novels like Nora Webster and Brooklyn as well, which, I mean, you do write from the female perspective?
No, the other two books came very much from the time I wrote them in, which was the years after my mother and her two sisters had died, and my father's sister had died, and that they wouldn't come back, and that there was almost no one else would remember what certain things were like, and so that I was trying to recover them. And I had remembered so much and imagined so much. So with Brooklyn, I just simply imagined that my Auntie Harriet had gone to America rather than stayed home. And then, but I knew all of, I mean, they talked so much in the house, and they would often put you out of the room when it became what they called private. But up to that point, you could listen for hours as they discussed the most banal business, you know, such as a winter coat that Auntie Maeve almost bought and then didn't buy. And and then they'd all discuss the price. But if you went downstairs, there could be two men sitting. And one said, that was a good goal on Sunday, this first goal. And the other, I mean, Beckett, you know, the second man would say, the second goal was also a good goal. And the first man would say, oh, it was, you're right. And he said, oh, this is ridiculous. I'm going back upstairs to see if there's another coat that someone nearly bought. And, you know, and I was trying to get that world back, just simply have it back in the room with me, do something with it, communicate to the world what this lost world was like. So, no, that was a completely different thing.
Right, further hands. Yes, there's one up the front. Wonderful. I'm also keeping an eye on you lot up there.
Hello. You talked about the pain of having to kill off characters, and you deal with a lot of subjects which are really quite dark. What is it that motivates you to write? What is it that keeps you going? What is it that you particularly enjoy?
Oh, I'm a failed poet, and that's a terrible thing in Ireland especially, because there are quite a lot of us and people despise us, and you know, it isn't a great position to be in. But I suppose, you start with that basic business that someone who's a singer wants to sing, and they want to sing for a crowd, they want to sing for people. And the idea that actually you want to do this strange thing and write a book for other people to read that is not a mirror. In other words, you're not looking in the mirror for something to see yourself more clearly. The page is blank. You're attempting to fill it so that other people will feel this. You can pass this on. So when a book is finished, you close it. It's for others to read. And I think that's a basic part. I mean, seemingly in the caves, when all the other men would go out hunting, you know, the little novelist would stay behind to draw the animals they were going to come back with. So that when they came back, they had an image of the animal. And so it's hard to answer the question why, other than, well, my friend John McGahern used to have a lovely answer. The Irish novelist John McGahern used to say that he hoped he didn't have another idea until after Christmas. You know, and this would be, he'd say this around April to me, you know, God, you know what I'm hoping for? And I'd know what he was hoping for, because once the idea came, he'd know that his life was going to now be taken up with this, trying to get it right and trying to describe all of this. And that I suppose it's a calling. I suppose it's something that you need to do, and you need to finish each time. You know, it's great to be able to do it, but the why part is strange, because you actually, every so often, you realize, oh, an image has come. It's like you're back in that landscape of Wexford again. I can see something I hadn't seen before, see a drama or hear a rhythm, and I know that the next two or three years are now going to be taken up with this. And you almost feel it with regret, but also a sort of longing to finish it and get on with the work. So it's a funny impulse, but you're right. I mean, it makes no sense. It's not as though it makes any actual sense.
Are you working on a thing? What are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm trying to finish a book of stories. I thought I had it done, but there are two stories that need a lot of work. And I'm lucky that I had enough time where you could reread them and think, there's something really wrong with these. Someone else would have told me, I think. There are certain people in the audience who know me well enough to say. So I'm going back to work with those and to really rewrite them. And make them maybe much longer to see what I can do with those. And they're both set back in Wexford. They're both, I mean, I'm not going back there again. I just, they've caused me enough trouble, and I've caused them enough trouble. So we've called it quits on the Greek business.
Very good. Okay. Does somebody have them? There's a hand. If a mic could go into it, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Two questions, I think. So I'm German, and I wondered if you're familiar with Christa Wolf's kind of interpretation of that myth told from the story of Cassandra. And if so, I'd like to get your opinion. And then she kind of linked the themes of patriarchy and war in her retelling of that myth. So I was just wondering if you also kind of saw those themes emerging.
Yes, I mean, I think that's particularly With Christa Wolf writing at a certain moment in history, being able to use this story as a sort of powerful story that she could tell where everyone around her would know what she was really talking about, which was the GDR. But this has come, I think, much more with Antigone, where at certain key moments in the 20th century, audiences or writers have become fascinated by the idea of, for example, during the French Resistance, are you brave enough to go against, are you Antigone or are you Ismene, her sister? So the plays at certain moments in history, I think, do have a particular resonance, and Christa Wolf certainly used that at a key moment in the life of the GDR. So yes, I'm absolutely aware of that, and I'm aware that these plays won't leave us. It isn't as though the idea of are you brave enough? I mean, even in the current, say, American administration, when I look at a figure like Paul Ryan, and I say, are you brave enough to do what you should do? Or are you weak enough to go on what you're doing at the moment? At what point will you break? Will we see you more clearly? And the best way to dramatize that, I wouldn't like to put Paul Ryan actually on the stage or anything, but the best way to think about that is almost to go back to that moment of Agamemnon. Will he or won't he? What's the right thing to do, and what are you going to do, and which of them, you know? And I think that's something you could put up to Rosenstein or to indeed James Comey, or indeed, James Comey can almost be seen at the moment as a sort of an Electra figure moving across the square, the public square, into a space where he will get to speak. So it's not just the women who get to do this, but that we will all be watching James Comey and the tone and text. I mean, his, for example, how he will handle anger, how he will manage that. And we know what that's like because we have these plays to teach us what that's like and what the conflicts within the self are as this person emerges into the light, whether he's Paul Ryan or James Comey, say, just in the current American situation. I won't go into the Brexit matter just now for the moment. I could some other time.
So interesting that the Oresteia, for example, was barely produced. There was a whole 15-year stretch. So there was a well-known production, I'm talking about Britain, in London in 2000, Katie Mitchell's production, 2000 or thereabouts, and then a sort of 15-year gap where nobody really wanted to touch the Oresteia. And then suddenly, a couple of years ago, sprang up three productions, one of which was the Robert Icke production that was done round the corner, and then extraordinarily for a Greek play, Greek trilogy lasting 4.5 hours, transferred to the West End. So there is a feeling that somehow, on some level, this particular story is speaking to us now. And it's not obvious, actually, why that should be. Everyone's taken a slightly different glance into the play, has drawn different aspects out of it. But I think it's really fascinating that it has sort of bubbled up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's in the last few years in London, it's absolutely become what every actor wants to do, is to come out as Clytemnestra. You know, if you're not Clytemnestra, you're nobody. I suppose it beats Alan Ayckbourn, which, you know, he used to be older age, so it's maybe it's a bit better, you know.
A couple of questions, really. I wondered if you could say something about the title and its significance, because you talked a bit about you didn't want to name the gods. And also, I rather like the character of Agamemnon. You haven't said a lot about him, and you've talked a bit about men and not necessarily always writing from the perspective of a sort of strong male character, but you've indicated that Agamemnon is frail. I just wondered whether there's anything in you that reaches towards writing from the perspective of that sort of wounded male character or a leader on the way down?
Yeah, I mean, just to answer the first thing, I mean, I think it's very difficult to write a hero. And so once you're confronted with the possibility of that, you look for weakness in that. And that's drama. I mean, when you find that the hero is not heroic, you then can actually work with that. But the important thing is that the boy Orestes doesn't see this. It's the mother who sees it. The boy Orestes spends his time trying to be his father. His sword fighting, it becomes obsessive so that he can seem like a warrior, so he's waiting for his father's return, or he's desperate to see his father at the camp. And so that it has to be careful that it isn't as though this man is fully broken, fully wounded. It's merely that Clytemnestra just sees in one second in him something that she's not noticed before, and that has to be a dramatic moment, but it isn't as though the boy sees it. So you have to make it, I suppose you have to try and be as subtle as possible in undermining a hero and finding levels of weakness. So it's not just pure weakness, in the same way as it's not just pure heroism. House of Names is that they're in this space I talked about, this special magical space, and they realize that
this is when the boys flee and go
yes,
to their sort of
yeah. This is when
sanctuary.
The boys are the sanctuary, and the old woman is running this place, and they realize there were many other people. It's clear from the clothes or the way things are growing or the configuration of the house, and she says, well, of course, the men were taken for the war. Ah, the war, and then the others had fled, leaving her behind because she was too frail to follow. And she mentioned even the grandson with the limp, the one she loved most, he looked behind once as he went away, and just get that sense of her being left there in a house. And then I go back into an Irish thing, which is John Millington Synge's Riders to the Sea, which is the immensely powerful moment towards the end of that one-act play, where the old woman, having lost all her sons, they've all drowned one by one in the play, she recites their names, just one by one, to say Stephen and Sean, as she goes through. And it's I think it's the beginning, in a way, of the Irish theatrical tradition, that moment when she does this. It's very, very powerful. And of course, Synge had taken so much from Greek theatre and studied it so carefully, and as indeed had Yeats and Lady Gregory. And that the old woman says, you know, this was a house of names. And she almost wants to start saying the names, and then something stops her, as though it will be too sad if she starts saying so-and-so is in that room, so-and-so is in that room. And then, of course, when the boys go back to the palace, too, was a house of names. Agamemnon was there, Iphigenia were there. They're not there anymore. And so that idea of also there's a moment where names become important, where Clytemnestra cannot remember names. And so I just thought the title, I liked the title House of Names, that I thought any house where people have lived is a house of names.
That's an incredibly haunting notion, and it reminds me also of the Iliad, which is one of the foundation texts of, obviously, the Oresteia, and the sense that a whole book of that poem is taken up with essentially a list of names, the people, the catalogue of ships, where the kings and the soldiers came from, yes. And the sense that it's almost, it's keeping loss of memory at bay.
Yeah.
But in your story...
Which the Old Testament yes. also does, yes. That idea just naming.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fading already yeah. in this very plangent way.
Yeah.
I think we have time for one last one, if anybody has one. Yes, put the top.
I read an article in The Guardian magazine where you were asked what your greatest fear is, and you said that Ireland will eat me. I think I know what you mean by it, but I wonder, is it something you're just saying later on in life, or exactly what do you mean?
The question is, I was asked in The Guardian what my greatest fear was, and I said that Ireland would eat me. And I suppose I was thinking, first of all, it's completely flippant. I just was trying to think of something I'm really afraid of. And my friend, the novelist Anne Enright, has a wonderful way of handling this. She says, I'm only Irish on Monday. You know, the rest of the week, I'm just a perfectly normal person. And, there's a whole sense of, it happens where, for example, if you're Irish, people think that you must be a natural storyteller and that stories must be coming out of your ears from Ireland. And you think, I think back to those two men in the room below just mumbling to themselves about nothing much. I think that I actually come out of silence, but that also I get so in such a state about Ireland. I mean, I could argue with Ireland for the rest of my life. I could write novels like pamphlets about the state of the health services, the education system. I'd love to reform the whole country. Don't start me on the border issue at the moment. I'm to be tied on the border issue, you know. And obviously, I became highly excited during the period when People, outsiders, like Polish people, Nigerians and Chinese were coming into Ireland. And I just thought, well, of all countries in the world, since we've gone so many places ourselves, we surely would want these people. And so I had to have a big argument. I would walk along the streets in a rage over some minister who was threatening to deport people or use sort of systems to stop asylum seekers coming in. And I thought, actually, sometimes, you know, East LA is the most neutral space for me. It's so far away from anything I know. Everything grows differently. Hollywood is miles, and the traffic is so bad you can't go anywhere. So you just sit there in a daze until some rhythms for books occur to you. It's a neutral space. But also, I try and find a neutral space anywhere I am. You know, I wrote some of this book also in Ireland on County Wexford, where I'm from, but it would be miles away from anything. Where, you know, I would, the nearest thing I would get to news would be I'd put on an old Bergman film late at night to cheer me up. But so that Ireland wouldn't eat me, you know. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Colm Toibean talking to Charlotte Higgins. House of Names is published by Viking. And that's all from us for this week. You can join in the discussion on Twitter at Guardian Books or on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast, which is also how you'll find us in your favourite podcast app. Next week, we'll be taking a wider look at novelists' fascination with reimagining classics with Booker longlisted Carmilla Shamsie and Preti Teenager. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and our producer, Simon Barnard, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.